Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're looking at a man whose image, I mean, that wild electrified hair, right? And that grin, just pure chaos.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe the most famous two-word greeting ever in American comedy.
Hello, Dare. Absolutely. We are diving deep into Marty Allen. And look, if you only know him from, say, game shows, maybe some old nightclub clips, well, you're missing so much. Mm-hmm. He was definitely that goofy, wild man comedian, sure. But underneath all that, Morton David Alpern. And his story, it's defined by this intense sense of duty, real bravery, and just incredible professional discipline. That's how we work for, what, nearly seven decades?
And that's really the core mission for us today, isn't it? We want to move past just the catchphrase, just the hair, and understand the whole professional journey. This guy was a master of longevity in show business.
He really was.
So we need to unpack all of it, not just the comedian and actor parts, but, you know, the decorated WWII veteran part, and we mean real heroism here, verifiable stuff, and also the tireless philanthropist angle.
Yeah.
Our goal is basically to pull together these sources and figure out why people called him the darling of daytime TV.
It's a huge career. It really is. Born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, March 23, 1922. And he was active from like 1950 right up until he died in 2018.
68 years.
Yeah.
That stands generations of entertainment.
It really does. And the thing that strikes me is that contrast, you know? The guy known for being totally unpredictable, zany. Well, underneath, he might have been one of the most reliable, most disciplined pros in the business.
Okay, so let's start digging into that. Part one, the origin story. We've got his WWII heroism and his early comedy roots. We need to see where that discipline came from. So where does the story of Morton David Alpern actually begin?
Well, he came from pretty solid working class roots there in Pittsburgh. His parents were Jewish immigrants. His father, Louis Alpern, came over from Romania or Russia, somewhere around there, and ran a local restaurant and bar. His mother was Elsie Moss Alpern. He went to Taylor Alderdice High School, graduated in 1940, and interestingly, much, much later, like almost 70 years later, in 2009, they inducted him into their Alumni Hall of Fame.
Wow.
So, yeah, you get a sense of those strong community roots he had.
But the moment that really flips the script on the, you know, the professional clown image is his time in World War II. We know he served, but the sources really emphasize he wasn't just in the service. He was a decorated hero.
Exactly. He joined the U.S. Army Air Corps. He was stationed over in Italy and eventually made sergeant. Now, the medal, this is crucial to understanding him, the soldier's medal.
Right.
It's specifically given for acts of heroism that don't involve fighting the enemy directly. It's about bravery in other dangerous situations, you know, moments of incredible selflessness, often under extreme pressure, where you put others first.
But if it was in combat, what happened? What was the situation that needed that kind of, well, instant heroism?
The sources describe this incredibly dangerous scene. A plane, right, was being refueled and it caught fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, just think about that. You've got aviation fuel everywhere, highly flammable, an aircraft that could just explode, people nearby. I mean, it was an imminent disaster waiting to happen, just not from enemy fire.
Okay, so what did he do? What were the actions that actually earned him the medal? Because the description is, well, it's pretty intense physically.
It really shows amazing presence of mind. His first move, the really smart, critical thing, he saw the bigger picture, he got in the fuel truck and drove it away from the burning plane.
Okay, smart. Get the extra fuel out of there.
Exactly. Eliminate the risk of a huge secondary explosion. But then, and this is the part that just defines him, I think, he didn't just play it safe. He didn't just stay with the truck.
He went back. Towards the fire.
He went back on foot
to
the burning plane. And he didn't like grab an extinguisher or wait for the fire crew, apparently. He took the most direct, personal, and frankly dangerous action possible.
Which was?
He basically smothered the flames with his own body. He rolled over the fire in his uniform to put it out.
He rolled over the flames with his body.
Yeah. I mean, the risk there, severe burns, obviously.
Yeah.
But he did it to stop the fire from spreading. It's just astounding bravery. Pure instinct to protect.
It is. Yeah, that's pure duty, sacrifice. You don't do that unless it's just baked into who you are, protecting others. How did the Army recognize this? Was it just a piece of paper?
Oh, no, it was a big deal. His actions were seen as so critical, so exceptionally brave that they honored him with a full dress parade.
Wow.
Yeah, this very public military recognition. It really sets a foundation, doesn't it? The guy who'd later make people laugh with total chaos was fundamentally shaped by military discipline, quick thinking, and, well, self-sacrifice.
So let's fast forward then. It's the 1950s. This decorated veteran, like a lot of guys back then, pivots into show business. How did he get his start on the comedy scene? Did that early stuff set him up for what came later?
Well, you have to think that discipline from the service probably helped him handle the, you know, the grind of the club circuit. In the early 50s, he teamed up with his first comedy partner, a guy named Mitch D. Wood. They weren't the main event yet. They were the opening act, you know, warming up the crowd for the big stars. But look what they opened for. Sarah Vaughan, Eddie Gourmet, Nat King Cole.
Whoa. Okay, so even as openers, they were playing at the highest level, learning how to handle crowds waiting for musical legends.
Exactly. They were getting tested every night in these top-tier venues.
Yeah.
A big highlight was playing the Copacabana in New York. I mean, that was the place for sophisticated nightclub entertainment back then.
Right.
So that partnership with D. Wood lasted until about 1958. They split up after roughly 8 years, which, you know, paved the way for the partnership that would really define him for the next decade.
Which brings us right to part two. Allen and Rossi, the peak of stardom. Okay, so he parts ways with D. Wood, teams up with Steve Rossi, and boom, they go from being a respected club act to a national sensation. What was the chemistry there? Why did it click so well?
That switch from D. Wood to Rossi around 57 or 58 was just everything. Steve Rossi was the perfect foil. Rossi was, you know, smooth, handsome, often the singer. He was the classic straight man, impeccable.
And Marty Allen was?
Pure chaos. Wonderful, magnificent anarchy. The hair, the energy, the constant interruptions, the physical comedy. He was the engine driving the absurdity.
So the visual contrast alone was like a built-in comedy routine. Rossi sets it up. Allen either lands the punchline or just blows the whole thing up with some crazy stunt.
That versatility was huge. And it wasn't just on stage. It translated really well to records. They had a string of hit comedy albums. And back then, a hit comedy album meant your material was everywhere. People
Right.
bought it, listened at home. It massively boosted their fame beyond just the clubs.
Okay, we absolutely have to talk about the Ed Sullivan Show because the numbers here are just staggering. 44 appearances total. That's not just being a guest. That's practically being part of the furniture.
It really is. To put it in perspective, very few acts ever got that kind of sustained run on what was easily the biggest variety show on American TV ever. Elvis Presley, for comparison, only did 3 appearances. So 44 times means Allen and Rossi weren't just popular, they were reliable. Ed Sullivan's producers knew they could count on them to deliver laughs week after week, basically. They were a known quantity, a guaranteed draw.
It keeps coming back to that reliability, that discipline again, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To get booked 44 times, you can't just be funny once. You have to be consistent, hit your marks, probably be easy to work with backstage. It's that duty thing again, but in a professional context.
Absolutely. Showbiz looks like chaos, but real longevity takes incredible structure. And maybe their biggest test of professional survival happened on, well, arguably the most famous night in 20th century TV history, February 16th, 1964.
Yes. The night the Beatles made their first appearance on Sullivan, the cultural earthquake, where the audience famously couldn't hear anything over the screaming anyway, let alone care about whoever else was on the bill.
It was pure, glorious mayhem. And our sources say Allen and Rossi had the, let's say, challenging job of performing on that same show. Imagine trying to do your carefully practiced routine with that wall of sound coming at you. Teenagers just screaming for the Fab Four.
Yeah, you'd need more than just good jokes. You'd need some way to connect instantly to disarm that specific energy.
And that's exactly what Marty Allen did. It shows his amazing quick wit, totally off script. He managed to cut through the noise with this perfectly timed, perfectly absurd line. He acknowledged the whole situation, but grabbed the room for a second. He just yelled out, "I'm Ringo's mother."
Huh. That's brilliant. The sheer nerve, the self-deprecation, connecting right to what everyone was obsessed with, it's genius. It breaks attention and says, yeah, I get it. This is crazy, but I'm here too.
Exactly. It showed he could handle any situation. He wasn't trying to compete with the Beatles. He was joining the party, making the impossible crowd laugh with one spontaneous, perfect line. That little anecdote, it explains so much about why they were so successful. They could work any room.
So the partnership had a really solid run, 1957 to 1968, and they even did a movie together, right? That 1966 spy spoof, The Last of the Secret Agents. Allen played Marty Johnson in that one.
Yep. And here's another important detail. When they did split in 68, the sources are clear it was amicable, friendly, which, you know, in show business breakups, that's pretty rare. It says a lot about the respect they had for each other.
And it wasn't just a polite statement for the press, apparently. They didn't become bitter rivals.
Not at all. They clearly had this lasting professional bond. Allen and Rossi actually got back together periodically for shows through the 70s, the 80s, even into the 90s sometimes.
Really?
Yeah. That enduring appeal, decades after their TV peak, shows their act wasn't just some flash in the pan. It was a solid, adaptable comedy team.
That longevity theme just keeps popping up. Okay, so being part of an iconic duo is one thing, but when the duo splits, that's the real test for an individual performer, isn't it?
How big of a risk was it for him, really? You know, the wild, goofy comic trying to do serious acting. That's the perfect setup for part three, the versatile star from comedy to drama and daytime ubiquity. And yeah, it's incredibly risky. When audiences are basically trained to laugh the second they see you with that hair and everything, trying to sell yourself as a dramatic actor, that's a tough sell.
But he pulled it off. The sources say he made it work.
He absolutely did. His first big serious role was in 1968, right after the split with Rossi. He was on that classic Western show, The Big Valley.
Okay.
And maybe the character name helped ease people in. It was dramatic, but the name was Waldo Diefendorfer.
Waldo Diefendorfer. Even in drama, he's got that Marty Allen flair in the name.
Right. It feels like maybe a bit of a nod, you know? A character that might start serious but could have that quirky edge. But honestly, the real key to his success and survival after Rossi was just how much he was on TV. He saturated the airwaves, especially daytime, which is how he got that perfect nickname, the darling of daytime TV.
So what was it about daytime TV in the 70s and 80s that made him such a perfect fit? Why was he everywhere?
Well, he really was everywhere. Hundreds of TV appearances across those 2 decades. And think about what those shows needed, especially game shows and variety programs back then.
Quick wit.
Exactly. Quick wit, the ability to fire off one-liners without a big script, and just reliable, generally family-friendly humor that worked for that broad daytime audience. His skill set was a perfect match.
He really became a game show fixture. And back then, being a regular on those shows meant you were culturally relevant. Big time.
Oh, absolutely. Getting a regular spot on the Hollywood squares, that was like the ultimate seal of approval for being funny, recognizable, and spontaneous. The whole show was built on panelists being quick and clever off the cuff. Allen's whole career was about fast, absurd thinking. He was born for it.
Yeah.
He was also on Password a lot.
So again, that reliability wasn't just about showing up, it was about delivering laughs consistently on demand, which is a real professional skill, not just luck.
Precisely. It's not like a sitcom where writers feed you lines. Game show panelists, the good ones, had to bring their own comedic personality and timing. Marty Allen just had this comfortable, familiar, genuinely funny presence people liked having in their living rooms. He was part of the TV landscape.
And it wasn't just game shows, right? His range on TV was pretty wild.
Totally. The sources show this incredible spectrum. He did things like Circus of the Stars.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah, which needed physical skill, a willingness to do spectacle, completely different from cracking a joke on Hollywood Squares. And then, okay, for anyone who grew up in the 80s, the ultimate cameo.
Don't tell me. The Imperial Pooga.
The Imperial Pooga, yes, in 1989 on the Super Mario Bros. Super Show.
Amazing.
It just shows he wasn't precious about his image at all. He'd do a serious role, he'd do a silly cameo on a kid's show. Whatever kept him working and connecting with audiences, that adaptability, that's the secret to staying relevant for so long.
It really is fascinating. And he did a lot of made-for-TV movies, too. 10 of them, apparently, including that spoof Murder Can Hurt You back in 1980. So this wasn't just occasional guest spots. It was sustained work in different formats.
And his movie roles show he wasn't just stuck playing the crazy hair guy either. He took parts in things like the musical drama The Great Waltz in 1972. He played a real historical figure, Johann Herbeck.
Wow, okay.
Then he jumped to a sex comedy, Harrod's Summer, in 74.
No.
Then A Whale of a Tale in 76.
That's quite a mix. A historical figure in a musical, a 70s sex comedy, and then later he's back in big comedies like Cannonball Run 2 in 1984. He really knew how to pivot and just keep working.
He understood that visibility was key. Never let the audience forget him. Never let the industry box him in. And if we tie this back to our main idea, this professional versatility, it's kind of the entertainment version of his military discipline, right? Assess the situation, adapt, execute the mission successfully, no matter what the genre.
That's a really strong connection. Okay, so if the soldier's medal showed us his character, let's look at how that character showed up in his giving. Part four, the humanitarian and later career act. This feels like where the two sides of his life really come together, that sense of duty and the gift of making people laugh.
This is such a critical part of his story and often overlooked. His commitment to charity, especially helping the military community, was really direct and personal. Right after he split with Rossi in 1968, he started this annual tradition. He named it after his catchphrase, the Hello Day tour.
Turning the joke into something meaningful, what did those tours actually involve?
These tours, which he did every year until 1972, were specifically about visiting military hospitals across the U.S. These weren't like big shows on bases. They were visits right into the wards, talking with and, importantly, entertaining wounded soldiers coming back from Vietnam.
Wow. That implies a very direct, hands-on understanding of what those soldiers were going through, probably stemming from his own WWII service. He wasn't just writing checks, he was going to them.
Absolutely. Imagine the atmosphere in those military hospitals during the Vietnam War. These were young guys, often badly injured, maybe feeling ignored by a divided country back home. And here comes Marty Allen, a decorated vet himself, bringing some laughter, some respect, right to their bedside. It feels like a mission driven by real empathy and that lifelong sense of duty.
And his charity work went beyond just the military, too, right? He was involved in some serious causes.
He was. A really key example is serving on the board of the Epilepsy Foundation. Now, being on a foundation board isn't just showing up for a photo op. It means real administrative work, strategic thinking, serious fundraising.
Right.
It shows his commitment was deep and long-term, not just celebrity window dressing.
Okay.
And he also put his energy into the American Cancer Society, the Heart Fund, March of Dimes, Fight for Sight, Cerebral Palsy, a really wide range of causes.
Now let's talk about his personal life for a minute, because it really shaped the last big chapter of his career. He faced some real tragedy earlier on.
He did. His first wife was Lorraine Tridell. People called her Frenchie. He married her back in 1960. She worked at the Concord Resort Hotel in reservations or the office there. They were married for 16 years, but sadly, she died from cancer in 1976.
That must have been incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
But the sources point to this remarkable second act starting about 8 years later.
Yes. In 1983, he met Karen Kate Blackwell. She was a singer-songwriter, very talented, who was actually managing a restaurant in L.A. at the time. She'd been in show business before, but had kind of stepped back.
Right.
They just clicked personally and professionally really fast. They got married in 1984. Sidney Sheldon, the writer, actually hosted the wedding at his home in Beverly Hills.
So this sounds like it was a real revitalization for him, both personally and creatively, a new partner in life and on stage.
Yeah, that's exactly how it played out. From the 1980s right through the rest of his life, Allen and Blackwell worked together as this successful musical comedy act. It wasn't just Marty doing his old bits, it was collaborative. Her music, his comedy, it gave him this fresh way to perform all over the country.
And they worked together for a remarkably long time, especially later in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah. They became absolute staples in Vegas, kind of embodying that classic, reliable Vegas entertainer vibe. In 2007, I remember he's well into his 80s by now, they started this long run at the Gold Coast Hotel and Casino. Then they moved to other big places like South Point, Palace Station. They even did cruise ships.
And this wasn't just like one-off nostalgia gigs. How late did they keep performing regularly?
Right up until he was in his mid-90s. It's incredible. The sources talk about them performing to packed houses, overflow crowds, at places like the Rampart Casino, the Downtown Grand in Vegas, even the Metropolitan Room in New York City as late as 2016.
Wow. At 94 years old, still performing live, multiple times a week sometimes. That says so much about his health, his drive, and just how good that act with Karen Kate Blackwell must have been.
Absolutely. And what's also fascinating, even in his 90s, he saw the shift in media and embraced it. He did podcasts.
Right. Adapting One Last Time.
He totally stayed relevant. He was on Gilbert Gottfried's amazing Colossal podcast in 2014. And then really notably, he did a long in-depth interview with Marc Maron on WTF. That was episode 574 back in February 2015.
Amazing. Still telling his story, connecting with a whole new audience through a different medium.
Yeah, right to the end.
Which brings us to part five. Conclusion of a long career. We're talking, what, 68 years of active work?
Mm-hmm.
Just think about the changes he saw and navigated in the industry. From those gritty post-war clubs.
Right.
Through the absolute peak of TV variety shows, then the game show era, and finally landing this decades-long musical residency in Vegas that took him well into the 21st century.
It's almost unbelievable longevity. He was such a survivor, but also an innovator, always tweaking his act, finding new ways to connect, but keeping that core Marty Allen-ness, that lovable chaos. He finally passed away on February 12, 2018. He was 95.
And he was at home, right? In Las Vegas.
Yeah, the cause was complications from pneumonia. Passed away peacefully at home with his wife, Karen Kate Blackwell, right there with him. He's interred at Eden Memorial Park Cemetery out in Mission Hills, California. Just a remarkably full life, lived with incredible energy almost to the very end.
So if we pull it all together, the full picture of Marty Allen, or Morton David Alpern, you really can't separate the comedian from the disciplined man underneath. We found, what, four really key takeaways from looking at all this?
Yeah, I think four stand out. First, definitely the decorated WWII hero. Getting that soldier's medal for that insane act of bravery rolling on the fire, that just establishes core character, that sense of duty.
Second, the iconic comedy partner, Allen and Rossi, becoming this huge cultural presence through those 44 Sullivan shows, proving he could connect with anyone, even in the middle of Beatlemania.
Third, the versatile star, the ultimate professional adapter. He really earned that title, darling of daytime TV, mastering game shows like Hollywood Squares, but also successfully making the jump to drama with characters like Waldo Diefendorfer. Just showed incredible range and reliability.
And fourth, the dedicated philanthropist, using his fame, his catchphrase even, for those Hello Dare tours for the Vietnam vets, channeling his own service into helping others, plus all that serious board work, like with the Epilepsy Foundation.
Which brings us right back around to where we started, doesn't it? That deep link between his military service and his whole life in entertainment and charity. I mean, in Italy, he physically threw himself onto fire to stop danger. Years later, he's throwing himself into these hospital tours, using laughter as his way to maybe extinguish some of the pain and isolation those veterans felt.
So the catchphrase wasn't just a joke. It became a tool, almost a symbol of compassion, a way to offer some healing.
I think so. It feels like his drive to create joy and give back wasn't just something he did on the side. It seems woven into his very being, maybe stemming from that instinctive duty he showed back in the war. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? That's the final thought for you, our listener, to chew on. When he yelled, "Hello, DeRay," on stage for the, 10,000th time in his late 90s, was he just saying hi? Or was he, in some way, still on that mission he started back in 1944, using every single tool he had, bravery then, laughter later, to try and bring some light, some safety, some relief to the people around him? How much can one defining selfless moment shape an entire lifetime of public service, even when that service is making people laugh?